Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watts, and I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really excited to be talking on the phone with Hannah Samick Norton. She is the author of a historical fiction called The Sixth Surrender. And Hannah alludes herself to being a real historian, delving into the 13th century France with really, really rich storytelling. And I can guarantee you that this is going to be a fun interview, so stick around. You'll be in for a heartwarming surprise. But first, a little bit about Hannah. Hannah Samick Norton was born in the former Czechoslovakia, a small country packed with history. That history eventually caught up with her and her family, and they came political refugees to Canada. She has an MA in history from the University of Western Ontario and a PhD from the University of New Mexico. Hannah currently lives in New Mexico, where she sometimes teaches her favorite subject, which of course is history, delves into the more serious aspects, and now writes the sort of stuff that she likes to read, fiction that is historical, romantic, and researched. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Irene. How are you?
Good. I'm glad to be talking to you. I was really interested in knowing what made you interested in history.
Well, that's an interesting question itself.
Yeah, I know.
I was actually pondering it the other day because I was writing something on my blog, and there was a quote from an American historian who actually identified reading historical fiction and history as being one of the sources of a gateway drug for somebody to become interested in history. And what he said was that most of the practicing historians that he knows were first attracted to their subjects by reading historical fiction.
Interesting.
So there you go. It's one or the other. You start reading it before you know you are pursuing the subject.
Wow. That's an interesting concept. Is that how you got into historical research and writing your own book, is by reading historical fiction?
I think so. I think that's how it began when I was very young.
Uh-huh.
I picked up a whole bunch of books that were written in the 1920s and, you know, from the early 20th century. There were these marvelous stories, and I just became totally captivated. And I read them all, and as I read them, I sort of became interested. Well, is it true?
Uh-huh.
And so that's how I became interested in history. And I'm still a great fan of historical fiction and historical romance. I think it's a wonderful supplement to sort of the dry stuff of history that sometimes historians write. Not all of them, but
right.
But you know how that is.
Yeah, I do. And you mentioned you were interested in the books that were written in 1920, so I'm very curious. I don't think myself I've ever read anything that was written at that time. So what is the difference between, you know, books written in 1920 and what you read and how they're written now when it comes to historical fiction?
I think the difference was, and of course at that time I was living in what is now the Czech Republic, then Czechoslovakia.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, my access to books was pretty much stuff that was not being censored by the communists, and that's pretty much what my friends and my parents' friends had in their houses. And I think the difference was that there was much more of a literary tradition that blended a wonderful story along with the history itself. And it was pretty much a reading that entertained me as a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
But it also provided pretty much sort of these flights of fancy. What was it like to be living at those times? And many of the novels that I read were translations from, let's say, German or French. And so they had that wonderful French flair for the dramatic, you know, things like Scaramouche that I absolutely adored. And that sort of took me to a totally different world.
Yeah, and certainly because that language itself, like you were talking about French, is a very romantic language, and so, of course, the writing would be more romantic.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, France, of course, is chock full of history, as is whole Europe, but I think the French have a sort of a special affinity for their historical fiction. I mean, you know, Alexandre Dumas and the Three Musketeers and Queen Margot, which I still have in treasure, and it's all thumbed and falling apart, but I still have it. It's that sort of a sort of the attitude that historical fiction is worth reading, and that there is something to educate you and entertain you at the same time.
And you know, as you're saying this, now I'm thinking, well, the United States is really not very old, and so you know, there are some historical fiction that's written, events that take place here. But however, when you're talking about Europe, I mean, Europe is old, and so there's just so much history to it. And it seems that a lot of the books in historical fiction are written, you know, with European flair.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think you're right. I think many of the readers, and I have been to several conferences. I went to a wonderful conference in Denver called the RomCon, and it was very well set up because it had the writers along with the readers, and there's a number of just wonderful young women, absolutely, you know, as bright as Penny, and just anxious to read and to meet the writers, and the writers just love meeting their audience. It was so fascinating. And I started talking to these young girls, and I said, well, what is it that really interests you? And, of course, their interests were, you know, anything from vampires and werewolves to, you know, the American West. And so that was great to see. But I think what you do is you develop a sort of a niche in reading. And I think because of, you know, several instances, the very popularity of novels, set, for example, in Scotland or in England. I mean, the Tudors. They are just a cottage industry, which I think is wonderful. So people sort of develop these niche reading areas, and that's pretty much all they read. And it was sort of interesting because I ran into a young woman, and she's asked me, well, what is your book set in? I said, well, actually, it's set in medieval France. Mm-hmm. And she says, oh, I love medieval France. Nobody writes anything about medieval France. And I thought, well, that's not exactly true, but that's all right. And she says, oh, I'm so anxious to read your book. And then I talked to her friend, and I said, oh, I know, what do you like to read? And she gave me this very cold look, and she says, I don't read anything else except about Scotland.
Oh.
I thought, okay. So there you are, and I thought, well, and you're still friends.
And, you know, it wasn't that long ago I was over at local Barnes & Noble because I wanted to know what the kids are reading right now, what the teens are reading, or the, you know, the, oh, 8 to 12-year-olds. And after talking to the person that was in charge of that department, I was really amazed that historical fiction is really popular with that age group.
Is that right?
Yeah. And so she took me to the books, and it's like, wow. And it's the girls. The girls mm-hmm. are really interested in, you know, the American West and the pioneers and just, yeah. So there's hope.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was watching the TV the other day when Oprah had J.K. Rowling on.
Uh-huh.
Did you happen to see it?
No, I didn't. I missed that one.
You know what? It was fascinating because what she was saying at the beginning was sort of, you know, the statistics of how many of Rowling's books have sold.
Uh-huh.
And it's like 400 million copies worldwide. And it's like absolutely mind-boggling. And you look at these, you know, kids cheering and welcoming her, and it was so heartening to see these kids reading. In fact, somebody was told me that she can be credited with single-handedly saving literacy in the publishing industry. But you're right. I mean, there is, I don't know if it's, you know, if it's just generational, but, yeah, there is a great deal of interest in just reading, I think, for young people,
uh-huh.
and especially historical fiction. I know, of course, that's always been, I think, popular, you know, Little House on the Prairie and those novels. They have certainly had a great appeal that never seems to wane. And I think that's because of the sheer wonderful storytelling.
I think so, too. Well, you mentioned Little House on the Prairie, and, you know, it's still running on TV, too.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, after all these years. So you consider yourself as a real historian. And I really like that. I read that somewhere, and it's like, wow. You know, not many people can claim that. And I want you to tell our listening audience, what is a real historian?
Well, you know, actually, it's an embarrassing confession because I wear my two hats, and I actually have a hat that I wear when I go out as a writer, and I have a T-shirt that says author on duty, which one of my friends made for me. Sort of to distinguish me from my other professorial self, where I do not wear a hat. And it is basically a sort of a right brain, left brain exercise, I think, for me. And I'm using my real name.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's something that is important to impart to my students. I started writing as a challenge to myself. You know, I do challenge my own students to do the writing. And, of course, it's very often difficult for them. And so I make them write and rewrite, and I give my own example. Even though I write, you know, professionally, writing fiction is something totally different. and I need editors. I need help. I need rewriting. I'm occupying a totally unfamiliar space from what I have been trained to do. I work and write in an area which is not my area of specialty, but I think it's important to stretch yourself and to do, you know, as Monty Python used to say, now for something completely different. And that's pretty much what I do. So my academic background is certainly something that enables me to perhaps have a broader understanding of the subject that I'm writing about. But on the other hand, it is something that I have to set aside when I have my imagination take hold.
I can well imagine. How much research do you have to do, let's say, for this book, The Sixth Surrender, that you just recently published? How much research did you have to go into to really get the background, the story, the plot, to get your imagination going?
You know, that's a pretty interesting question, because right now I'm standing in front of a wall full of books. And, you know, that's one of those occupational hazards of a historian, and a lot of the criticism of historical novels is that they tend to be loaded up with information and sort of dry, and every single piece that you ever found out, the author sticks in there. And I'm thinking, well, you're saying it was a bad thing. But, of course, I think that's wonderful, because that's, as a historian, my little left brain, that's what I want. But on the other hand, of course, it is a fine line of doing research. I did an awful lot of research, and, in fact, it was funny. I got a letter that my publisher forwarded me, which was very sweet, from, obviously, a lady who is not a young person, and she says, can you tell me what is the fact and what is the true? I can't tell them apart. And I'm thinking, wow, that's either a praise or a condemnation. I wasn't quite sure which one it was. But I spend a lot of time doing historical research. For me, in a way, it's easy because I know generally I know the big picture.
Uh-huh.
But it is the little things, I think, that I come across in doing research that I'm after. It's the nuggets that I think is something that makes a story rather than the big picture. Mm-hmm. Of course, my period covers 4 years, so there's a lot of political stuff going on. But it's the little the little bits that sort of tend to get me distracted. And I do read a lot of publications that are basically in academic journals just to hunt for that one piece of information. Right now, I'm writing a sequel to The Sixth Surrender, and I'm absolutely being driven nuts by the question of how long did it take to sail from Marseille to the Holy Land? You know what I'm saying? It's just one of those things that drives a historian up the wall. Most people probably wouldn't care, and there doesn't seem to be a definitive answer, of course, because it depended on the time of the year and the weather and pirates and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and, you know, I never gave that much thought, but you do really have to, for instance, in this case, how long did it take to sail? Because really, true, avid historical fiction readers do want the facts. They do want the truth with, of course, the embellished fiction part of it, don't they?
You know, that is actually a very interesting question, because I run into this when I teach a class, and, you know, my students would sort of, you know, raise their hand like they do politely, and they say, well, isn't it the truth that?
Uh-huh.
And then you sort of fill in the blank. And very often I have to stop, and I'm thinking, you know, being a historian is sort of like a lawyer. You never give a yes or no answer.
Right.
Always hedge your bets, because I'm sure there's a monograph on it somewhere which you haven't read. I think there is an interest in knowing the truth, but I think a lot of the reading audience, this is just, you know, one of my comments coming from me as a historian, there is a sort of an assumption that certain things are true, even though they necessarily are not. And very often what surprises people is when you introduce an idea or a concept that sort of flies in the face of what they think have happened or what should have happened. And, you know, sort of telling history the way it is, of course, would be just writing a historical textbook. Telling fiction is you have to remember, no matter what you read, even though it does provide historical background, it is a fiction.
Fiction, yeah. And sometimes, you know, as you had mentioned earlier, is it truth? Is it fact? Is it fiction? You know, how as a reader do we really decipher all that?
Well, you know, I don't know. Do you really want to decipher?
I don't know.
Do you want to take on the, you know, the reading of historical fiction as a sort of the gateway drug to actual serious study of history?
Yeah.
I think if you do, that's great. One of my one of the issues that is sort of funny dealing with you know, identifying what is quote unquote true is that very often readers and my own students do the same thing. You know, I'm trying to give them the big picture and the big concept, and they of course try to concentrate on the minutia, looking for specific. Very often looking for specific, especially nowadays when you have access to computers, is very easy, right?
Right.
You can always Google a date or a person, and I think that's a wonderful resource, and I do encourage it. But at the same time, remember, those are sort of snippets of a mosaic, and just by reading the snippets, you don't necessarily know what the big picture looks like. So one has to be careful when, you know, trying to find out what is the truth. The truth is sort of a movable target. For example, one of my great concerns when I was writing this, and this is, of course, what happens to you when you are a real historian, is, now, wait a minute. Is there such a thing as a concept of treason in the 13th century?
Ah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. We're speaking today with Hannah Samick Norton. She is the author of the historical fiction, The Sixth Surrender. And as you've heard so far, Hannah is a very interesting person. And as you can tell, her passion for history really, really comes through. Stick around because you're about to experience the fun side of Hannah. By the way, her website address is thesixthsurrender.com.
It's sort of the bigger picture, and I decided that from reading about it is, of course, that the concept of treason began to develop at this time, because treason is you know, a crime against the state.
Right.
Well, was there a state?
Interesting.
See, that's what gets me off track and rushing off to do a research in another monograph in, you know, in medieval history. But that's, of course, also for my own enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the nuggets are interesting. When you compare readers of, science fiction,
mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody's going to ever comment that, I know for sure that levitation chamber on Alpha Beta 2308 is green, and you said it was blue. You've got to be wrong, right?
Right.
Nobody's ever going to do that, right?
That's funny. But that's a good analogy.
Isn't it, though?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought about it when I was, you know, somebody was commenting saying, well, this structure or this thing didn't happen when she says it did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe it did and maybe it didn't. See, so there's this additional, I think, layer of challenge for a writer and a reader in writing historical fiction, which is what I think it makes it so attractive. It's sort of like a, you know, like an egg hunt, Easter egg hunt.
Yeah. You know, it's there, but yeah. That's interesting. Hannah, you teach history.
Yes.
And, you know, we're in this technological age. The information is just so accessible to everybody with the Internet, as you had just mentioned. But, you know, are we losing something like history because of this?
That is a very good question. It seems to me that we are in a sort of a transitional phase. The technology is changing so fast that, my goodness, it makes my head spin. I mean, you know, I have to ask my students about what is it you're talking about? What is it you're doing? I have no idea. And my defense is, hey, I'm a historian. I'm interested in the old stuff, you know. If it's not written in quills, I don't care, you know. I think the framework for the understanding of this avalanche of information is incredibly important, and I think we might be losing that. In other words, knowing more and more makes us understand less and less. But again, that I could be, and I do hope that I am proved wrong. But I see it. I see it in my students, where sort of the it's what I call the smorgasbord approach. Is that there's all this information, but which one of them is the really important thing? Mm-hmm. And it's like anything. It's technology has its upside and it has its downside. And who was it that said, you know, the question is not whether machines think, but whether men do, or in our case, women as well.
Right.
So the technological question and the impact on literacy and impact on our knowledge of the world around us, I think the jury is still out.
And we're not going to know, probably for a long time.
Yes, exactly.
Never. Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, I mean, the invention of the Gutenberg press that historians think about as being probably, in fact, I was looking online the other day and somebody was listing that as the first truly momentous invention that had transformed the world. The printing press. Until that time, of course, documents were written and copied by hand, which was, of course, something that limited access to written records. But also with that, you have to remember that the people who lived at that time before the printing press had absolutely phenomenal memory. I mean, they were literally walking encyclopedias. And, well, let me put it this way. I can't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday.
Yeah.
So for me to think about a person who could literally memorize an entire book and then repeat it from memory is absolutely astonishing. And we have lost that capacity. We don't have to remember everything. We can always, you know, Google it.
Google it.
Yeah.
Yes.
They couldn't Google it. It had to be all in their brain. And so the invention of the computer and our access to information is probably going to be as monumental as the invention of printing. Of course, we are now going away from printing into the electronic media, where the books are supposed to be the hardcover books are supposed to be on the way out, replaced by basically a string of electronic data. Now, that to me is a fascinating development.
Yes, it is. But I don't know. I still like hardcover books.
Yeah, I do too.
And for reading, it's like, I don't. So, Hannah, you know, there just seems to be more and more people that are also interested in family history. I was interested in myself. I've done a lot of research and found some fascinating things that were deep, dark secrets that nobody wanted to talk about. And so, do you have any idea why, you know, all of a sudden people are just more interested in even doing their own family history? Research, finding out who they really are?
I think, again, it has to do with the idea of rootedness. I think because we are so overwhelmed by the information and, you know, things seem to be moving so rapidly around us. The question is, you know, where are we going? And many people find that discovering where they came from might be useful as a milepost, so to speak, in their lives. And I think that's where the interest in rootedness in families, you know, how do you forge a family? Are there any deep, dark secrets? Well, of course there are. But people have survived those, haven't they? And they have moved on. And I think one of the reasons why historical fiction is also so much unpopular is because, first of all, it does deal with families or with relationships.
Yes.
And I think that's where the resonance comes in with you mentioned about youngsters being interested in reading history, is that I think it's the effort to understand how do you create a family, how do you pattern your own behavior, how do you find a mate. Those things have happened to their families clearly in the past. And I think people are looking for some sort of a guidance or reassurance that they were and they will be in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. You know, being that I do family history research myself, I believe that too. I'm kind of thinking now, why did I start? And it was really the interest in this. Like, where did I come from? Where did my husband's family come from? Who are these people? And, and I know that I'm not the only one because there's just so many people doing family history research now. So, Hannah, let's talk about your book, The Sixth Surrender. Tell our listening audience what this book is all about.
Well, that's an interesting question. It's one of those 30 seconds elevator pitch.
That's right. You've been practicing.
You're never, ever prepared for. So I sort of ducked that question by basically saying it's a tale from a time when chivalry reigned and treachery ruled, which has a sort of a nebulous description, but it is basically about sort of this forging of a new relationship and a new family. I deal with the last years of Eleanor of Aquitaine, which is, of course, a story of a woman who is extremely popular these days, even though she has been dead for 800 years. Again, the interest in the personal is right there. And so I pick up her story at sort of towards the end of her life when she's realizing that she has to save the empire that herself and her husband Henry had built from the vices of her last surviving son, which is, of course, John. And to do that, she uses a couple of unlikely individuals who are my fictional characters. Juliana de Charnay, a young woman who is a novice at Fontevraud Abbey, and a man of rather mysterious background by the name of Guerin de la Salle. And Guerin's character is actually based on some of my research into the 13th century, where there were a number of mercenary companies run by mercenary captains that Richard and Henry had used in order to fight their wars. And so Eleanor uses this man of a rather dark background, but clearly somebody who knows how to fight, and as a pawn along with Juliana, this young woman who is, how should I put it, naive but not stupid.
Uh-huh.
And Eleanor sees them as a key, or rather their marriage as a key towards preserving the patrimony for John. And LaSalle and Juliana become then these keys to preserving this much, much bigger legacy. So you have sort of a story of a beginning of a family and the influence of another family on the preservation of political power. So we have the politics on one side and then the personal and the romantic, of course, on the other side.
Did you have fun writing it?
Yes.
Yes.
I am afraid so, yes.
That's great. You know, as I'm listening to you, just the passion is coming out from the story, and you're explaining your story, and I'm thinking, I bet she had fun. The imagination.
Well, if you write anything, and if you're a writer or a reader, you do know that sometimes characters just pretty much, you know, take over, and you're going, whoa, what happened?
Yes, so. Yeah, I know. And so, are any of your characters, the characteristics of them or anything like that, based on people you know or on yourself?
Oh! That's an ambush question there.
I know, it just came out.
Well, I mean, you know, even though writers say, oh, no, none of these characters resemble me, of course, you know, they are lying, right?
Yes. So,
well, yes, of course. I mean, I hope just the nicest parts of me, of course.
Yes.
Snarkiest and darkest parts of me that occasionally come out. Yeah, Juliana is, of course, based partly on me. Not so much in her attitudes, but basically as somebody who is grappling with understanding the world around her. And I sort of try to put myself back into what was it like to be, you know, a teenager. What was it like to be one of those young ladies who come up to you at a conference, very much excited about this book or that book, and you can just see it in their eyes, sort of this anxiety and this excitement and this desire to know things at the same time when it's not quite possible for them to know it simply because they are still too young. And sort of this, you know, learning curve where do you come from and how do you learn? That was one of the things that I sort of tried to use through the character of Juliana, because I was thinking of my own experience coming to, after I came to Canada and then to the United States. You know, as a young woman, I didn't start learning English until I was 15. I felt pretty much totally out of my element. I was, you know, sort of ostracized in school, but it didn't really bother me. But, you know, how do you find your way through that? How do you establish your own self? So I hope, you know, some of the nicest aspects of Juliana are certainly parts of me, and some of the nastiest aspects of me are part of other characters, but I won't tell you which ones.
Okay, and I'm not going to ask.
Okay.
Oh, Hannah, your website address.
My website is www.thesixthsurrender.com, C-O-M.
That's great. There you go, listeners. Wasn't it fun listening to Hannah talking today? She's just such a delight. Thank you so much, Hannah.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Irene.
And listeners, there you go. Hannah Samick North with The Sixth Surrender. Check out this book. I think that you're going to be really amazed and pleased. Hannah's just such a fun person, so you can imagine her personality coming out in the book, too. So, Hannah, thanks again. Listeners, this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.